Well, we begin a new adventure today. I wonder if any of you have ever read a book and you started somewhere in the middle. Ever tried that? If you have, some things probably won't make as much sense. You'll be running into characters and you'll be saying, now why is he here? Who is he? How is he related? Maybe more common to you than starting a book in the middle is coming into a TV show in the middle. That's not maybe the best analogy, because I don't know that TV shows are written with the same level of quality as the Bible. But still, you get a sense that you may in that TV show or in that book get to the end, and there's the punchline or there's the twist, but it doesn't quite make sense because you weren't there at the beginning. This is more so in the Bible, because the Bible's not just story, it is history. It is what creation's all about. So it's very, very important, if we're going to understand things correctly, that we start at the beginning. And so this morning, as you know, we're in Genesis 1 and 2. I'm going to pass out the handouts. No, it's not the same handout as before. It's a different handout. Can I erase the board?
Yeah.
And so the handout's coming around. We're going to use it today more than we usually use our handouts, partly because we're not doing a verse-by-verse study today. We're doing... Well, we can't do all of Genesis 1 and 2 in a half hour. So we're going to be focusing on certain things, and so I'm going to use the handout to help us. And you can see on the first page there, I just put an outline, my outline of the two chapters. I don't think there's anything special about it. I think it just, if you want a refresher, you want to kind of see just real quick what's going on here. I think a lot of this is familiar to us. Just the main storyline, God creates the world, 6 days, he rests on the seventh, and then there's another account in chapter 2 which focuses on the creation of man. And woman together. They're complementary accounts. One gives the bigger picture, one gives a more focused picture. They have some different emphases and highlights. But if you flip open then to the middle of the handout, you'll see I repeated there the questions, instructions for today, what I suggested, recommended that you do before class and as much as you could through the week to be prepared. And so those are there in case you weren't here last week or didn't read the email. And even if you did, just to have them there. And this gives you a clue, too, as to where we're going. When you say Genesis 1 to 2, we could do a lot of different studies, but these specific questions give you an idea that we're going to be focusing on the creation of man in this section, and specifically verses 26 through 28. And let me say too, I hope you did spend some time in Genesis 1 and 2. I was going to ask you to turn in your homework up front here. I do accept late papers. There is a deduction on your grade. And there's a lot of ways you could do the pre-work. You could do it in your head. You could write it out. You can work on it through the course of the week. You can do it in a more restricted time. But the more you do, the more you'll benefit. And two, I think it's also fair to say, and this will be true probably every week, there are going to be a lot of things you think about, you study, you learn, that we won't talk about here. There will be questions you have that we won't answer. That's okay. But I think it's just fair to... And there may be questions you ask this morning that I just ignore. we're not going to be able to look at what I want to look at if we talk about how long are the days, like what are the arguments for the 24 hours of day, or is man greater than woman here, or and there's a lot of different little issues that could tie us up, and I'm going to try not to get tied up. So, I wrote down here 19 observations. We're not going to look at all 19 observations either. Some of them are broader. These are just sort of things. This is kind of how I do Bible study. I mean, for me, Bible study, I don't know if I should admit this, but I think I should, actually. What is Bible study? The difference between Bible reading and Bible study is one thing. A pen. That's the difference. If you read, you don't have a pen or pencil or computer, you're going to probably go quicker. You're not going to slow down. You're not going to stop. If you're studying and you have a pen, or I usually type, as I can type a lot faster, you're forced to go slower. You're asking questions of the text. You're suggesting answers. You're interacting with it. And it's wonderful. And I know you know that, but some of you need a reminder, I'm going to guess. So, these are just observations I made, and I didn't plan to talk about them all, but I thought it might be helpful to have some of them, and some of them you may disagree with. Some of you say, I see it, but that's okay, right? We're provoking each other, we're learning from each other, and if it pushes you forward, then that's a good thing. Some of them you may never have thought of, and it may push you back to the passage and see, is this really right? So I'm going to skip, like I said, I'm going to skip some of these things. I'll skip number one. Let's go to look at number two here. I say, and this is something everyone agrees on, the pinnacle of God's creation is man, right? Man is, and when I say man too, we can use it in the traditional English sense of man and woman. Man is the last created thing. Right before God rests, he creates man and woman. Everything else builds up, leads up to that. Not only that, observation three here, we see that man is the supreme object of God's creation by the responsibility he gives him. He puts him in charge of all his creation. So there's really no question about the supremacy of man in God's creation. Now, point number three is a very important point. Maybe I should have, developed several points out of it. But I want to spend a good bit of time here. And in fact, let's read verses 26 through 28. And talk about what's going on. That's really what we're doing today, is we're studying these verses. And it doesn't end here, and you can see in the handout, in the next section here after observations, is these verses in later Revelation. This is, say, if you're not sure, is this really an important section? Well, when you see the Bible coming back and back and back to it, it becomes really clear that this is foundational. That's a very important word. What we're talking about today is foundational. We're laying, if I was to diagram the Bible, if I was to diagram history, I would put right down at the bottom of this of the building, this is Genesis 1 and 2, and I don't want to say other things in the passage aren't important, but everyone agrees, 26 to 28 is a peak in this section. And then, if I was going to keep diagramming this, next week, come back, because it's Genesis 3 just fits right on top of that, and then we're going to start to have some other things building off of it. But you can't understand anything in the Bible if you don't understand the first three chapters.
Before you head off, this will be your first opportunity to direct me back. But I noticed that in reading Genesis 1 and 2, both chapters, it seemed to be kind of a different literary type. It just seemed like it was different. Like chapter 1 was more maybe poetic, or 2 was more story-oriented. It was like, oh, you know, it's a dark and stormy night kind of thing. Now, it's just, is there any significance to, you know, because he kind of repeats himself between 1 and 2. Is there a difference that's significant there?
Well, there is a difference in the literary genre. It's not, chapter 1 isn't a poem, but it is, it's narrative, but it's elevated narrative. It's like high style, as it were. And then chapter 2 is not quite in the same way. But there's other differences between 1 and 2, like God's name in chapter 1 is Elohim, which is the term, the generic term for God. It speaks of him as the majestic supreme being. But in chapter 2, it's his personal name, Yahweh Elohim, which we translate, I wish we didn't, but the Lord God. Lord is Yahweh and God for Elohim. And by the way, I should also say too here, the chapter division between 1 and 2 is wrong. And everybody agrees. It should end at 2-3. That chapter 1 should end at verse 3 of chapter 2, and then verse 4 begins. That's where the division is. And it's very clear and obvious. But I don't know that I want to say anything more than that.
Okay.
I mean, I don't think it's contradictory. I don't think it's two different guys who did it. I think it's just different perspectives focusing on different aspects of creation.
Yeah, it just seemed like one was a higher level to kind of put us in our place, and then the second one was gets kind of into the story.
Yeah, I mean, in the second, I mean, not only does it use God's personal name, but it is more intimate. I mean, God is fashioning man with his hands out of the dust, and chapter one is more God speaking and stars appearing and verse 26, and God said, let us make man in our image, in our likeness. Let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground. So God created man in his own image. In the image of God, he created him. Male and female, he created them. By the way, we've talked about this before, but whenever you have repetition in the Hebrew Bible, that's a importance, stressing it. And so here, it could just, you could drop out verse 26 or 27, right? I mean, one or the other would be enough, because in one of them, God says, hey, this is what I'm going to do, and in the next one, and he does it. But that's meant to slow the reader down to say, hey, hold up here, something very important is going on. Verse 28 says, God blessed them. There's only three things he blesses in this section, and one of them is when he blesses man. And said to them, be fruitful and increase in number, fill the earth and subdue it, rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air and over every living creature that moves on the ground. So, we have a number of things going on here that we want to consider. The main thing is God creating man in his image. In his likeness. Those are two words. Image, he made in his image, in his likeness. What does that mean? And what are the repercussions from that? And I don't want to, there's a lot of ways we could go with that discussion that I don't want to go. I don't want to talk about psychological sorts of, you know, analysis. Or I want to keep it simple and say that can't disagree that what distinguishes man from the other created beings must be part of that image of God, right? Because none of the other created animals have the image of God. Only man does. So you can just look, and I don't know that you have to do some doctoral dissertation, though they've been done many, many times, on what it is. You can just look, like, okay, I have a dog, I have a fish, you know, you can see bears and giraffes, and how are we different from them? And I think a child starts to understand that. Conscience is one of those aspects. Without going too much further down that road, I think we kind of intuitively know that the distinction. I want to talk about some things we maybe don't think about as much, and that is not man in a certain way has the essence of God. He is God-like in certain qualities, I would say, like conscience. But he's also God-like, and this is the stress of the passage, he's also God-like in his function, right? Because how does the passage basically explain who man is? I mean, let us create man in our own image and in our likeness. So what? He rules. Let him rule over. And then it lists what he just created on the previous days. All of these other things are going to be under man. And then 28, God specifically commands man, rule over the fish, birds, and every living creature. So man is a ruler. God, when God created man in his image, he created man to be a ruler. Or say it this way. God is the sovereign, and he is giving his sovereignty in a limited way to man. I drew this chart up here years ago, a little graph, but it's so important. I think there's countless errors made in biblical studies and interpretation because they don't understand one simple truth concerning the kingdom of God. There are in Scripture two kingdoms that are talked about, but it doesn't have a footnote and says, okay, now I'm talking about the universal kingdom. Oh, now I'm talking about the mediatorial kingdom. But they are distinct. And we see it already in chapter 1. We see it through the rest of the Bible. The universal kingdom is a reference to the fact that God is always king. He's always sovereign. He's always in charge and control. Always, always, always. The psalmist David writes, Psalm 145, "Your kingdom is an everlasting kingdom, and your dominion endures through all generations." This is God's universal kingdom. Nobody's ever sovereign over God instead of God. He's always sovereign. But God designed, God intended, when God created man in his image, that man would be like God, ruling over his creation. This is the mediatorial kingdom. Because man, Adam, the first was the first one, is the mediator of God's rule. God is giving to Adam some of his authority. Not unrestricted authority, and the tree of knowledge of good and evil is the clearest object which shows the limits of his authority. Adam doesn't have, right? Adam's not taking over God's position. He's just within this created sphere. Adam is representing God. He is mediating God's authority on earth over God's creation. Now, let me just, if I jump out of Genesis here for a minute, this is going to continue when God gives to Israel, there's other things too, skip, but God is going to make Israel his mediator on earth. What does he say in Exodus 19? That we're going to be there in about a month. That's a very important passage. Exodus 19 says, "I'm going to make you a holy nation, a kingdom of priests. the nation of Israel was to mediate God's rule to the earth. And one day, I believe, some people don't, and that's too bad, but they'll see because it's going to happen. Israel will fulfill that function. God intended it, and God's going to fulfill it. And too, as part of that, not just Israel being the mediator of God's rule, but there's going to be there's a single individual, a leader of Israel, a king, right? David is God's king on earth. There's a sense in which too, David recognizes he's not the ultimate king, right? He's the mediator of the true king. David could say also in Psalm 145, the psalm begins, "I exalt you, my God, the king." That's the king wrote that. It says, "I exalt the king," because there is a king of kings. And ultimately, and this is touched on in a little bit in the further. I have a section here in the notes called "Going Further." You know what that's for? That's for the home groups. Now I know you're not all meeting this week. I know none of you are meeting this week, but I mean, we don't just skip the passage because you're not meeting. I mean, it's how do you? So I think maybe the thought is, when you meet next week, a week from now will be the beginning of them. Some of them starting that Sunday night and then Wednesday and such. That maybe you'll come back to and look at week one and week two this week and next week in your study. But one of the questions I ask here, I'm kind of sneaking this in, how does this our study affect your understanding of Jesus? And I'll just give you a little hint here. Jesus, Adam fails, right? Adam did not exercise his rule over creation the way God intended because he disobeyed God. He did not recognize someone else's sovereignty over him. Right? I mean, that's the problem in the garden. Is Adam says, "No, I'm the king. I mean, I'm the king, and there's not another king. And if I want to eat that fruit, I'll eat that fruit." And that was the fall. Jesus. So, what does that mean? That means, well, you know what it all means. I mean, the how the earth is cursed and all that. Well, Jesus is going to be the next, right? This the last Adam, or the second Adam, who's going to be born in the line of David, so he has the legitimate right to the throne of Israel, but he's going to succeed where Adam failed in the temptations. And he's going to say, "I am not God." Now that gets a little bit tricky there, but he's as man on the earth, he recognizes God's, that he's representative of God's rule on earth, and consequently, then, and jump to the future, Jesus is going to mediate God's rule on earth in the kingdom, the millennium, and beyond, as the perfect Adam who did exactly what God intended for man to begin with. Let me say too, and this is new. I got this morning. I was doing some squeezing in some last minute reading. I thought, I got more, you know, I got a list of things that I could do. Just, you know, wherever I run out of time, then I don't. But I'll see what I read. Eugene Merrill's book this morning, and read part of that, and he makes a really good suggestion that I don't think I'd ever thought of. Try this on, and he says in there, he says, "I make this suggestion tentatively because I don't think too many people have ever said this before." God gives Adam rulership over the creation, including the animals. And so the animals, remember this, I'll slip this in here too. The animals are named by Adam, which, by the way, is reflective of his kingship, right? Anybody here ever named somebody else's child? You don't. I mean, we've named six children. Our son Timothy would be 11 today. Yeah, it's his birthday. He died when he was a baby. But we named our kids because they're ours. We don't name your kids and you don't name ours. But Adam names the animals because God gave him the rulership over them. Now, the text doesn't say, I want to be a little bit careful where the text doesn't say, and Dr. Merrill says this too. Dr. Merrill, Eugene Merrill, is a professor at DTS, by the way, but a dear, dear godly man. He says, suggests that those animals, Adam didn't have to go chasing after those animals to find them, to name them. But they came to him. And maybe, can you think that maybe Adam could say, hey zebras, come over here. And they came. To support this idea, you can note in Genesis 9, after the flood, when God says to Noah, you can kill and eat the animals, which is a new thing. Now you have the enmity between the animals after the flood and all the evil that went on in connection with the flood. But it could well be, it seems quite likely to me to believe, that Adam had a happy, peaceful relationship with the created animals, which then was interrupted by the fall. But Jesus, do you remember when Jesus says to Peter, throw your nets on the other side? So, how do you explain that miracle when Peter catches all those fish? Actually, happens more than once. I remember once early in Jesus' ministry, and then again after the resurrection. How does Jesus... Does Jesus know? Does he have x-ray vision? Oh, I see the fish. They're going over there. Or, this is what Merrill suggests, and I think it's a new thought to me, Jesus, acting as Adam, demonstrating that he is who God created man to be, commanded the fish, swim all together over here. Or when Jesus says to Peter, go and throw out your line and catch a fish, inside it will be a 4-drachma coin, use it to pay the temple. Is that trying to show Jesus' command over the creation as a way of saying, I'm the one you've been waiting for. I am the second Adam. I am the one who can do the way, who can act as God intended man. Yes.
Isn't it the same kind of situation where the disciples realized when he calmed the sea, who is this man that commands
him? Yeah, I would say there... I would call that a demonstration of his deity more than his humanity. So the other ones, I'm saying, it's not a divine thing to tell the fish to go over there. It's an Adam thing. But with the storm, you have like Psalm 29, which I think that's that's one of the references where God is commanding the storm and the seas. And so Jesus, when Jesus commands the storm and the seas, the disciples all know, who does that? We know from the Old Testament, only God does that. And I don't know that Adam would have, I don't think Adam had could control the waves, per se. So, but that's a good connection. Yeah?
You've made a premise on that there is an authority that Adam has over creation. How do you relate that?
Yeah. Well, I don't know if it does. I think, does that imply opposition?
Yeah.
I don't know that it implies. I think it's, he says, fill the earth, because there's only two of them. So he wants them to reproduce, and their children to also be rulers of their own domains. And... But I think he's in the garden, chapter 2, and it says, verse, It has him taking care of the garden in verse 15. He took them in and put them in the garden to work it and take care of it. I think that's the idea of subduing there. I don't think there's a conquering of an opposition, but more of a this is the paradise, and you live here, you work here, you enjoy the fruits of it here. That's how I understand it. But I could be wrong, and I would need to, because I did not study that word. And the main way you study the word is you see how it's used elsewhere in the Bible. I didn't do it, and I didn't even see it in my reading. So it's not a big one on other people's radar.
That's what I was going to ask you, what the Hebrew
is for
subdue and rule.
I don't know.
Well, you've got, eventually that Cain was thrown out into the wilderness. It seemed like the garden, was this really nice place, but there was outside.
That's after the fall, so I want to be a little bit careful about what conditions were like. How big was the Garden of Eden, and what were conditions like outside of it? You have clearly here, this is a long part that most people kind of go, what's that all doing in here? In chapter 2, these rivers, it's like 5 verses about the rivers. You're like, what do we need all that for? But maybe it's only, yeah, it's 5. The point I think there is, the waters of life are coming from the Garden of Eden. They're flowing to the world, giving life to the world. And that would also suggest, I don't make a big deal out of this, but where does the Garden of Eden have to be if the waters flow down to the rest of the world? Okay, so they got to be elevated. Got to be some kind of a mountain. The waters are, if there's gravity, and there's nothing to suggest that we don't have normal conditions with regard to gravity. So, was there another hand? Yes.
I don't know if I'm asked once on this, but
well, if you are, I'll tell you.
Thank you. Well, the serpent, when it came to Adam,
oh, the serpent.
Was he under Adam's rule? Like, should he have subdued the serpent?
You know? Should Adam have subdued the serpent? Yes. I mean, I don't know that, there's a lot of mystery there. So, but I want to say, Adam, right, he failed with regard to the serpent because he listened to the serpent. And he didn't, he was submissive to the serpent and not submissive to God. And, but yeah, there's some things there that I don't know. And we're going to talk, next week is Genesis 3. So, Tony?
On 2:19, it says that God brought the animals to. So, it's like, I don't know if Adam was controlling them. It says, he brought them to the man to see what he would name them. So, it seems like that Adam didn't call them, but God had actually brought them in.
Okay. Yeah, great observation. And let me just kind of go beyond that, too, to, this isn't going to answer that particular question, but in the kingdom, right, the future kingdom, the millennial kingdom where Jesus is king and ruling the way that, in perfect submission to the Father, the way that Adam should have done. What's the situation like in the animal kingdom? Yeah, well, you say the lion and lamb. It actually never says the lion will lie down with the lamb. It does say the wolf will lie down with the lamb. It'll say that the child will play with the snake. So we have some kind of, we have a removal of the enmity. Now, that doesn't mean perhaps, Isaiah 11. Do you guys remember that chapter when we were there? I loved Isaiah 11. I loved Isaiah 12 and 10. But Isaiah 11, it says, let's see if I got, verse 6. The wolf will live with a lion. The leopard will lie down with a goat. The calf and the lion and the yearling together. And watch this. And a little child will lead them. So does that suggest, is that some sort of a leadership over the animals, a restoration of the Garden of Eden? I would say so.
So the question of the serpents and the kingdoms, and there's reference to
I wouldn't.
I was wondering if there would be kind of like a dashed line in there, or it's one that man allows. It doesn't fit, I guess, that picture.
Like, well,
they clearly had an interim kingdom under God's sovereignty.
Yeah. Yeah.
Man submits to it sometimes instead of to this universal rulership of God.
And yeah.
God will vanquish that at one point.
Yeah.
Or find it at another point.
I agree with that. I don't know how I would draw that on here.
It's kind of, in a way, that's almost an illustration of our difficulty of some of the mysteries of Scripture is they don't fit our two-dimensional pictures we draw sometimes.
Right. I mean, he's removing himself from that picture when he's submitting to Satan. Yes. Oh. Ron.
In addition to the ruling thing regarding image of God, I think that there is a very strong intention for man to maintain creativeness or creativity. I mean, I don't. Am I jumping the gun here?
No, 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 you're not at all. That's a great point to make.
Because he's charged with filling the earth.
Yep.
Creating more human life and also working the ground and creating more food. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that is such a key part of the image of man is his creativity, and that reflects to the fact that though there was the fall, we are still in the image of God. It's marred, but we still bear his representation, his likeness, we still create. And the irony of billions of people on the earth today who utterly deny the one in whose image they're made. But yet they're living out their lives, and some of the, it tends to, you know, the greater irony of the ones who are at the top of the pile, who are the most successful, who maybe in some ways have best utilized those gifts, who are the first to deny that there's a sovereign over them.
Another thing is the assuming of responsibility, you know, as part of the ruling thing, and when you say subdue the earth, men are to assume the responsibility for their part. So I think, I mean, that may be more parallel or synonymous thought with ruling, but responsibility is something I think we share with God, that animals really take on.
Yeah. That's right.
Well, it says being a good steward. So the scripture throughout is full of God is the perfect ruler, the perfect king. Man is short of that. All your teaching through kings are Jeff teaching through all the different kings. And there was so many good kings and so many bad kings and how you illustrated that. If you look at man's role here, we would be a little more environmentally friendly. I'm not saying we make flip everything upside down and make God, or make Earth God.
The creation is not God.
Creation is not God, but
which is the oldest lie in the book. But
being an effective steward and a good ruler, we would make the best of and would
That's
act
right.
on behalf of
That's right.
the things that are under our authority.
Right.
And the same thing for and even the last prayer in the book of Lord, come quickly. It's kind of really about, I'm ready for you to come back and set up this universal kingdom where it's right.
That's right.
Because it's not right now.
That's right. Because even I,
yeah.
as a redeemed child of God, am still fallen and cannot act as the steward, the right steward that God desires. So, and only Jesus can. Which is the message of the Bible. Like, you know, chapter after chapter is failure, 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 failure. Who's going to succeed? It's Jesus. So the mystery, why everybody doesn't bow the knee to Jesus and say, you're the only one who can do it. And Ron, did you have your hand up?
I think you answered that. I was going to ask you about the verse 15, the nature of the work that Adam did before the fall. Because he was assigned work before the fall.
I don't know.
We talked about it. You said creative and...
Yeah, naming animals and yeah, I don't know what all... I think this isn't going to help much, but I think it's going to be similar to what our roles are in I don't want to say heaven. I want to say on the new earth. Because we're not going to be fighting that sin, but we're going to have plenty of work to do, and work's a good thing. It's one of the observations I made, is that work precedes the fall. Yeah. Work is not a result of the curse. It's the obstacles and the frustrations of the creation that are the curse. But work itself is a good thing that God has created. So, well, I want to end with this. This is a little different, but Dave suggested that we might consider ending with worship this morning. We're going to do it this way, and our focus has been... Indescribable? Is that on there?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll tell them what to do. We focused a lot on man. The subject of chapters 1 and 2 is God, and so I don't want to suggest that that's not true. And I think we're showing man in his proper place, which is honoring and glorifying to God. But when we think about creation and all the aspects that we haven't considered so well, it's good to conclude with, David's going to play a song that talks about God and his creation and God himself over that creation. And let's just listen to, this is a song by Chris Tomlin called Indescribable. You're probably familiar with it, but maybe in light of just kind of meditating this last half hour on creation and God, it'll be more meaningful, and prepare our hearts too for worship as we go into the sanctuary. So we'll conclude, instead of a prayer, we'll conclude with this song.